This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have two sponsors for the show. The first is Jam Software, and the second is XMA All Learn. We'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you?
Fantastic. I am recovering from two things.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is some minor to everyone else, but not minor surgery to me. Mm-hmm. And then the very difficult 2 weeks of school Christmas program rehearsals. So
yeah, it's the longest 2 weeks of the year.
It is. Well, the challenge is that it's like we have them at 9 and at 1 every day,
mm-hmm.
but my job still goes on.
Yeah.
And so I'm getting like texts during the, hey, can you come help me with this? Can you come help me with that? And it's out of my nature to say, no, not right now, sorry. Particularly if they need something, but I am tied up there. So, yeah, the program is tonight. So by the time this show airs, it will have gone on. It's the title is pretty funny. It's called Christmas Myth Busters. So like the story of it is they're like busting myths and about the Bible or about the Christmas story, like that Jesus was born on December 25th, that the Bible never says three wise men. It just says there were three gifts in wise men. It's like mm-hmm. it's cute.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
So, last show of the year, starting in January, we're going to reopen our deployment discussion because things have changed quite a bit. I'm in the midst of planning for our next refresh, and I know you are as well, so it's like timely for both of us. So tonight, we had two things we wanted to discuss. First is the I'm going to link in the show notes to the BuzzFeed News article about Tim Cook saying Apple won't make the test machines taking over the classrooms. And then we're going to talk about Apple's deployment documentation, where to find that, and we'll have lots of links for that. So, you know, Tim Cook came out and said, assessments don't create learning, calling the cheap laptops that have proliferated through American classrooms mere test machines. We are interested in helping students learn and teachers teach, but tests no, Cook said. We create products that are whole solutions for people that allow kids to learn how to create and engage on a different level. Obviously, this is a shot at Chromebooks, which have really taken off in the U.S. You know, all this depends on what statistics you look at. And a large part of it is the fact that they're compatible with many standardized tests because it has a full web browser. So if it has some janky plugin it requires, it still works. So obviously, this was a shot at Google in a way, but also I feel like at the American education system.
Yeah, I think it is fair to characterize it as a bit of column A and a bit of column B. I mean, I think I was quoting a stat on Twitter today, which was Gartner had done some analysis of the 2014 market for Chromebooks, and they had said, I think we've mentioned this in the show before, that in 2014, something like 84% of all Chromebooks sold were sold in the US, and of that 84%, 60% of that went to education, and 38% went to consumer, and the rest went to other, which I suppose means business. So it's very interesting that of those kind of three segments, education, consumer, and business, that business has essentially zero interest in Chromebooks whatsoever, and education and consumer have the rest. But it's also very interesting how wildly US-centric the Chromebook phenomenon really seems to be.
Well, and now, I guess in response to Tim Cook, like you want to give him a slow clap, but there's an aspect of that of why can't it be both for the iPad?
Yeah, I mean, why isn't the iPad a good test machine too?
Right.
Well, I suppose because it costs a lot of money. You know, the iPad's really something that if you're going to bring it into your school, you have to commit to really use it. You know, you could in principle afford to buy a fleet of Chromebooks just for your testing regime. Because, I mean, heaven knows you guys test enough that those that would probably be the best utilization most computers have had in a long time is just to be put in as a round of test machines. But with iPad, you know, they are substantially much more expensive than Chromebooks. I mean, you're talking about twice the price, effectively, for something of similar abilities, I would say. Better abilities, right? But in terms of, like, you know, screen size and the kind of duration of time you would want to spend working on a device, you know, you can pick up a Chromebook for a couple hundred pounds, whereas you're at the equivalent iPad, in terms of how much time you want to spend using it, you're talking about, you know, £400 plus for an iPad Air 2, something like that. So I know the Mini, but you know the Mini is not not my ideal school computer to deploy. So yeah, I think there's a bit of both in there. It's a shot against Google, but it's also I kind of interpret it as a call to be more ambitious in school for what it is you want out of a computer. You know, and somebody came back to me on Twitter today and said, look, you know, isn't it just the case that the iPad overserves the teacher, and therefore the low end disruptor, quote unquote, Chromebook, is winning the day? And I said, well, yeah, that if that's a correct analysis, and it may well be, that is a bit of a shame that our schools and our teachers are so undemanding of technology that they are being overserved by something that most of the industry thinks is not quite powerful enough yet in terms of the iPad. And I think that's my bigger concern, more than you know which platform schools are using right now, is why would it be that the iPad is already too good for schools? Do we really believe that? You know, is the iPad too good for school? I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, you often have to ask yourself, like, if you think something's too good, you have lofty enough goals for what, you know, what it can do for you. An article came across my Twitter feed the other day about No Child Left Behind being kind of canned, apparently, mm-hmm. in the U.S. So, I don't know. I mean, obviously, Apple is, I think, very interested in education. Obviously, they like the sales with education, but I do think they genuinely care deeply about it. One thing that to me, and this is not a knock against Apple, but the Google Drive experience on Chromebooks is way better than mm-hmm. on iOS. But that's not really Apple's fault. That's a Google issue.
I mean, if I was the product manager for iPad, I would be lying down at the door of whoever it is writing those Google apps and begging them to make it better. Or indeed holding hostage somebody who runs the iCloud system and having them build out the capabilities that the iCloud lacks that Chrome or Google Drive has. I mean, to this day, you know, iCloud is basically, it does not include any sharing features. I mean, okay, you can share an iWork document on iCloud.com, but that's just an embarrassment compared to what you can do on Google Drive. And I think the only people I ever share documents with on iCloud.com is Apple employees just to punish them for shipping that system. Everybody else gets a Google Drive link. But I think, you know, there's work to be done everywhere. You know, I don't think there's no one perfect solution, but I, you know, having, as you know, and as listeners of this show know, having been through this every possible level, I cannot conceive of a way in which we would adopt Chromebook in the course of our next refresh. I mean, I've looked at it in all ways, and like financially it's really good, administratively it's really good, but educationally it doesn't float my boat enough to make it worth switching from iOS, especially not now with iOS 9.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's XMA. This XMA is a leading Apple solution expert in education. As an Apple solutions expert, XMA is perfectly positioned to support your institution with the deployment of iPads and Macs. They have built upon their 30 years of experience to create a new program for the iPad called the All Learn Program. With the All Learn Program for iPad, XMA can help you with planning, financing, and managing your iPad deployment. XMA can also use their accredited trainers to deliver Apple professional development to teachers and staff to ensure that you get the best results from your Apple products. To learn more about it, visit xma.co.uk, or you can follow them on Twitter at @wearexma. And we'll have a link to their website in the show notes. So if you need help with your iPad deployments, definitely check them out, xma.co.uk. Yeah, so good time. I think it's a good time for me to be thinking about a refresh, because it looks like we're going to get an iPad Air 3 in the spring.
You think so?
I think. Mm-hmm. I think. I really think we're going to see a split on the iPad refresh. And you're going to see iPad Air in the spring, and then iPad Mini and iPad Pro in the fall. Just going on record here.
I can believe that. I think that there's scope for there to be an A9 based 9.7 inch iPad, and I am actually deliberately planning my schedule to give enough time for that to happen as possible, or as much time as possible for that to happen, because I would very much like to be on an A9 chip for the next 2 years, because those chips are crazy fast.
So if assuming we get that, you would go with the iPad Air 3, it would not take the cost savings of a cheaper iPad Air 2.
Interesting question. Would I? The cost savings would have to be substantial. I mean, the nice thing about the Air 2 is that it also supports all the technical features, the software features that the 3 would support as well. But you would just get faster. And I think the way I would look at it is that I currently have budget for the mid-range fastest iPad that you can get that's not the Pro. And if I can get that budget again, I would like to do that again, because although nobody's really begging me for a faster iPad right now, I know that I can tell that our fourth generation iPads are starting to feel a bit slow under iOS 9. And not unusually so, nothing like as bad as it was with the first generation iPad after 3 years. But definitely, when you're signing a lease, you want to get the longest life you can. I mean, maybe, Bradley, the deal is get the iPad Air 3, but sign a 4-year lease.
Well, and when you say that the iPad Air 2 gets all the latest software features, that's mm-hmm. today. What happens 2 years from now?
True indeed. True indeed. I mean, if you rocked up with an iPad Air 3 that had 4 gigs of RAM, that gets interesting fast, because you know we do pretty heavyweight stuff. You know, we're looking at big Keynote files from some kid's video in them, big Procreate users in the art department, for example, and other things like that. And further, if we ended up with an iPad Air 3 that also supported the Apple Pencil, that would be a change in the conversation again.
Yeah, and then it would also be interesting if the iPad Air 3 got 3D Touch, where that obviously the iPad Pro does not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's many factors would come into that equation, I think, and it's not clear to me that all of them would be really important. You know, I wouldn't do it just for 3D Touch, and I'm not necessarily saying we're going to buy every student a pencil, because I promise you we're not, but you know, maybe there's a class set of Apple Pencils. You know, maybe that's where class sets come in. Do you know, I haven't actually tested with the Pencil because I don't have another iPad Pro around, but how do you switch pairing on a Pencil? Do you just plug it into a different iPad and it's now paired with that iPad? I suspect that is how it is. So that would be quite a nice way if you had, say, 10 Pencils for the math classroom or the art classroom. Then the kids could come in with their Pencil-compatible iPad and just plug it in for 10 seconds and then it's theirs for that period, and then the next person plugs it in. That would be really nice if that works, but I don't know if it does or not.
Yeah, I could see. Because doesn't the Pencil have a male lightning port on it?
It does. It has a sort of speed terminal on the end, yeah.
The thing would be broken so fast.
Yeah, I can see the teacher doing that for you, yes. Yeah. I think I probably wouldn't have fitted that. I would just open them all out of the box and I would just throw away the caps on the first day, because I just know it's going to upset me when they go. So I'm just going to throw them all away on the first day so it doesn't
Let's happen. Just ruin it.
Yeah.
Next thing we want to talk about tonight, and kind of just a way to end the year, is Apple's wealth of resources on deployment documentation. And I'll just say on the front end, if you're wanting something to kind of prep yourself for the Deployment 2016 series, these links will be where you want to start. These will help you with some of the terminology and some of the kind of the high-level concepts that Apple does a good job of designing. I mean, things have changed a lot since we first started looking at iPads and iPod Touches and Macs. I mean, Apple has really kind of upped their game and how they help you along, because the happier you are with your deployment means you come back for more.
Yep. You read my mind in that point, Bradley. This is kind of your holiday reading for Deployment 2016, is these particular documents. And there are others as well, don't get me wrong. These aren't the only ones that are available. There's also help documentation in tools like Apple Configurator. But these are the kind of high-level documents that are going to get you into, you know, if you are coming from a world where you don't know how to deploy iOS at all, these are the places you're going to want to start.
So first place you want to start is the Apple Education IT homepage, and that's at apple.com/education/IT. And again, we'll have all these links in the show notes. So if your podcast app, I don't believe Apple's app supports links yet. So if you're using the Apple podcast app, you can find these links at outofschool.net. And this will be episode 162. So again, we'll have these links in there. But again, first place you want to go and really just start poking around. I mean, when you go there, you see, you know, tabs for managing devices, device enrollment. And this is just a high level overview of kind of, what happens, how you distribute apps, how all this works together. This in some ways is your hub for learning about other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually two versions of this page. There's one for education at /education/IT, and there's another one. It's either /business or /enterprise.IT. And actually, the two of them are useful because the education one is very focused on deploying apps and content and sort of managing or configuring a young person's iPad, whereas the enterprise one is much more focused on security and data management. But I think in education, we're actually concerned about both of those topics quite a lot. So it would be very interesting to actually read both of those in parallel and just look at the different focus on both of those pages. But yeah, these are the kind of the high level moving parts. So these are where you learn the names of things like the device enrollment program, the volume purchase program. You start to learn about those specific pieces of the puzzle, if you like, when you're putting together your deployment.
And Apple typically updates these fairly quickly after iOS releases. I imagine this is like some guy's job is to make sure all these things are updated for each OS release, and they're usually done fairly quickly. So next thing you want to look at is the iOS Education Deployment Overview. Now, this is a PDF, so throw it in PDF Expert or whatever you want to do and mark it up with your Apple Pencil. And this is a kind of a long URL, so again, we'll just link this in the show notes. This is a real high-level thing. It's not something that's going to give you like the technical nitty-gritty of what your network infrastructure should look like. This is more of a, just walking you through step-by-step ownership models. You know, what are your options here? This is probably something for your senior-level employees to look at and be thinking about as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is the leadership piece, isn't it, Bradley? This is the one where, you know, you're going to take this to your head teacher, your board of governors, whoever it is, you need to kind of clue in on the whole thing, because it does talk about, it introduces you to the idea of institutional ownership versus student ownership, and it talks about some of the trade-offs there, and it talks about the trade-offs between one-to-one deployments and shared deployments. And it introduces the idea of the prepare, set up, deploy, and manage cycle. That Apple talks about that as kind of the four life cycle stages of an iOS deployment. I think it's a very useful way to think of it. And this is the kind of thing where, you know, you've seen it, Bradley, I'm sure, and I've seen it as well, where, you know, you go into a school and they want to do an iPad, they want to do one-to-one, or they want to do iPads in some form, and they've already decided the shape of their deployment. You know, they come in, they say, well, there's no way we can go one-to-one. And you know, there's no way we can possibly afford to buy them all. So it's obviously going to have to be a shared or a BYOD deployment or something like that. And you're like, well, have you actually really thought about the trade-offs there? Because I've had this experience many times that once I start unpicking the implications of what it is you've already decided, people change their mind, you know, in a New York minute, because some of the decisions that they make, I don't mean to be critical of people, but as somebody with a systems administration background, I have a perspective on the long-term deployment of computers that teachers simply don't have. And there's a way of thinking when you're a systems administrator that you end up thinking about, you know, what's that going to be like in year two and year three, and how does that roll over year on year? How do we refresh that? How do we ever change if we have to? And teachers often don't think about that. And one of the situations where they obviously haven't thought about it is when people decide they're going to roll out year by year. And then you can talk about the consequences of that. Like, you've always just bought new devices for somebody, so you can never get off that plan. So it becomes very difficult to do some of those things. And this document, I think, is really, really useful. If you were to just, if somebody comes to you and says, hey, we're going to do an iPad program, I would lock them in a room with you and this document until everybody understands the consequences of the decisions they're about to make. And I think this is an excellent document for just getting those questions out into the open and making people understand that there are trade-offs in every deployment model. There's no one way that is, you know, an unalloyed perfect way to deploy iPads. I mean, at least school-owned individual use one-to-one program is great. You know, the model that we have at Cedars is great. But man, we spend a lot of money on that. and we take a lot of care on it, and we take a lot of responsibility for deploying it. Whereas just letting people rock up with whatever iPad they want and plug it onto your Wi-Fi, well, that sounds a whole lot easier, but it has other trade-offs in other directions. And it's not to say that any one thing is absolutely perfect and everything else is wrong, but there are trade-offs in every direction. But I think quite often people look at this idea and they see the one that seems obviously best to them, and then they never recognize any trade-offs in that model. So this is an absolutely super document for that.
I'm reminded of when we were planning out our new playground a few years ago, and we had countless meetings after meetings and looking at plans and discussing it with architects and looking at landscaping and just, you know, hours and hours of discussions. And if you think about it, your technical deployments should be about the same thing. I mean, on the surface, it seems like we buy a truck of iPads and we pick some apps and we throw them out there. But, you know, you could argue the same thing with the playground. Now, you just throw some slides out there and some grass and you're good to go. But you want to do it right, and you want to think through all the caveats and the potholes and, you know, what do you want it to look like long term? Like, where do you want this to be at the end of it? And so it does require more of a sitting and thinking and like just talking with people. Like, what are your goals here? What would you like to see this do? Because I think if you talk to people, people have different opinions of how things should work. And you can maybe blend those together to find the best solution for your school.
Yeah. I think the thing that, you know, you said this last week, Bradley, that there aren't really many gotchas in iOS anymore. So when you sit down in this document and you say, well, okay, we have, you know, this is a red line and this is negotiable and all these different things, these factors that come into play for your school. And I'll come back to that point in a minute. But when you do that, iOS now has the capability to support almost any setup that you want to have. Okay, there are some obvious high-level restrictions around things like how do you deploy apps. There's only really one good way to do that. But in terms of, you know, if you have policies about where data goes or doesn't go or routing network traffic or something like that, you can actually achieve most of those goals as long as you sort of talk about them in the open and say, yeah, these are high-level goals that we need to have and we need to look at that.
So next thing we have here is the iOS deployment reference, and this is at help.apple.com/deployment/iOS. And this is where, you know, if the previous thing was like the soup, this is the steak.
Yeah, this is the deep darkness, if you like. And this is everything you need to understand. I can't describe it as, you know, Craig Federighi got up on stage and said, oh, okay, low power mode pulls all these levers. Well, this is where it tells you where all the levers are. And it also helps you understand the implications of pulling those levers. So, you know, in the deployment reference, you've got chapters on deployment process, Wi-Fi and network infrastructure, services integration. So, you know, you're talking about there things like, you know, what ports do I have to have open to make this a success? You know, services integration, how does this play with Exchange? How is AirPlay going to impact my network? Can I use a single sign-on service? You know, so if you do have existing infrastructure, this is where it's going to play. And then you've got security. So you can look at device and data security, network security, app security, and so on. Huge section on configuration and management, which goes into real depth about configuration profiles and activation and setup assistant and device enrollment and things like that, and also supervision. So you can get really down to brass tacks and say, well, okay, we're going to supervise. Well, what does that mean at technical level? What do we know that that's going to prevent us from doing, or how do we set up so that we know if we want to, say you want to have the ability to connect these supervised iPads to other Macs in your system. Okay, let's understand what supervision means. Okay, and then we find out there's a switch in configurator that lets us pair the device with other Mac hosts so that we can download photos or whatever it is we need to do. And then you've got app distribution as well in there. So it's a real, real good technical reference. Very deep, very detailed. And if you do read it all, you'll find that you know pretty much all the ins and outs of what's going to happen when you set up those devices. Not everything. I would say that there are some things that aren't completely covered in that document, such as just some of the consequences of some of the configuration profile flags. There's a few things like, you know, how often does this configuration setting prompt you for an Apple ID password, for example. Like, I discovered that if you set an app rating on an iPad, it will always prompt you to download apps from the App Store with a password, even in the case of updates, I believe, as well. So that can have an impact on your deployment and things like that. But then you discover that nowadays in iOS 9, there are other ways around that, such as forcing updates through your NDM. So there are, it's all about thinking about these workflows, and the deployment reference is really where you're going to get a lot of that information.
Well, and a lot of this is, if you're reading this and you're not like shaking your head thinking, I understand what they're saying, and you're starting to formulate a plan, this is where you may want to bring in some outside support.
Yeah, this is where, you know, people who are experienced in iOS deployment, they know the kind of questions that you need to be asking. And if they don't hear you asking them, if they're doing a good job, they will prompt you for your answers to questions like, what kind of configuration profiles are we going to have? How are we going to build those configuration profiles? Is it going to be one profile? Is it going to be layered profiles? Different things like that. So there is a kind of, there's a kind of level just above this document as well, where it's kind of, you know how like when you watch a sport that you're not familiar with and you understand the rules, but you don't understand the tactics and the strategy behind it? It's a wee bit like that. So this is kind of like the rules of baseball, if you like. But for me, as somebody who was not brought up with baseball, I can watch a baseball game and I understand that the guy throws the ball and you hit the ball. But then there's all kinds of other stuff like, well, why did he hit it that way? And why did he bunt here? And things like that you just don't understand unless you've been brought up with it. And I think the deployment reference is very good for like the rules of the game. But then you need a wee bit of help above that level to understand the high-level strategy and tactics that go along with just playing to the exact rules of the game as well.
Yeah, I'll give you a little baseball tip.
Why do people bunt?
Well, okay, so give you a good example. If you're on first base, mm-hmm. okay, if I bunt you to second, basically when you're bunting, you're saying, okay, I want to, you know, the guy's going to make it to second. Most situations in the guy who bunts is going to be out. Well, when you're on second base, you're in, it's considered to what's a scoring position.
Okay.
So a regular single to the outfield can mm-hmm. probably get you home if you're a fast runner. Now, if you're me and you run like a dried up creek, probably not. And so, and you know, other times too, like if somebody's on second, they bunt them to third because mm-hmm. then a sacrifice fly can get them home. So if you're on second, and let's say you're on second with no outs, but on the third, guy next, so you got one out, guy hits a fly ball, you know, as soon as the runner catches it, the guy can, you know, tag up and run home, scores without ever having a second hit. And, you know, that's been funny at school. Like, one of the consequences of kids not growing up playing baseball like they used to, it's a lot of kids are playing soccer or
football,
European football. is kids don't know the rules of like tagging up.
Mm.
Like, you know, when it's a fly ball, like you have to wait. No, unless it's two outs. If there's two outs, you just take off. Do you know why?
If there's two outs, you just take off. Because one's going to get home anyway?
Well, because if they catch it, inning's mm. over.
Ah, okay.
But if they drop it somehow, well, you're running and going.
So it's worth a try either way.
Yeah, I mean, you might as well go. And like another fun fact. If it is a 3-2 count, there's a runner on first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so three balls and two strikes. Okay. Three strikes is obviously an out, and four balls is a walk. Mm-hmm. The runner always takes off like he's going to steal second. Why?
Because if it's a ball, the guy's going to walk anyway to first, so the runner will get to second. And
well, I left part of that out. Full count, two outs. Yeah, full count and two outs. Yeah, two outs. He's either going to strike out,
mm-hmm.
inning's over.
In which case, the inning's over.
Right. Walk, well, he's on second anyways. Or if he hits it, gets a single, guy's on third because he was yeah. he was off.
Okay, so then you've made a double
right
advancement. Right?
And you never want to make the second out trying to go to third base. It's just like baseball, inside baseball.
See, this is where I've completely lost the thread of baseball entirely. Is see like that? I need five levels of explanation for that as to why that is the way it is. But to you, that's, you know, you can just describe that with so few terms, and you can visualize what it looks like. And I'm trying to add that up in my head. I'm doing math in my head to try and understand that. And you know, to bring this a little bit back to what we're trying to talk about, it's kind of the same thing with things like the deployment reference, is that if I say, okay, we're going to have layered configuration profiles, you know, I understand what that means and you understand what that means, but does your head teacher understand what that means? Probably not, you know. I think that's where different levels of documentation and having a friend who, or a trusted advisor who knows what they're doing and can take the time to talk you through it is useful.
Well, another one for me that I got asked about today was, like, basically, even if it was a bring your own device iPad Air 2 program, mm-hmm. or school purchased, because to me that question has gotten a lot easier over the past year with the device enrollment program. And I think for a lot of people, if you don't understand the benefits of the device enrollment program, when you think about that, you're thinking, well, it's just easy for the kids to bring theirs. It's like, but the, mm-hmm. you get so much kind of better control of the devices,
yeah.
when they're purchased through the school. And I just know that intrinsically because I sit there and read this stuff half the time and thinking about it. And like, I'm asked about it. I had a good call with a listener yesterday from down in Atlanta. And we were just talking about things like this. Like, it's things that you and I, we talk about, you know, to each other and to other people so much. It's just second nature. Mm-hmm. But just like you said, it's like inside baseball. Like, if you don't know this, like, you really have to think about, well, what are the benefits of like a bring your own device versus school owned? And well, it financially and just logistically, it seems like bring your own device is easier. But after, if you get through deployment day, gosh, mm-hmm. school loan is a lot easier.
Yeah, and I think it's similar in the sense that, as well, that you know, you can look at something like the device enrollment program, and you can say, okay, so if we're in debt, then we can apply these controls, but we might choose not to. And again, that's your kind of inside baseball tactics. Like, oh, okay, I could run here, but I'm going to decide not to because this and this and this and this. You know, and that's the kind of thing. The subtlety of that question is something that comes, I think, only with experience sometimes. You know, and I know that I have made those mistakes. You know, when we did our first deployment, the biggest mistake I made, or one of the big mistakes I made, was that I set a lot of our profiles to be never removable, instead of removable with a password. And never removable means you literally have to erase the device and start from scratch to ever get rid of that profile. And I spent many hours wishing I hadn't done that.
Before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night. It's our friends at Jamp Software. They provide ICT staff with great tools that power widespread use of Apple products in your schools. It includes Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs. Now, if you're enrolling one of the new Apple TVs, make sure you have a USB-C cable. And I'll link to one in the show notes that I actually just picked up. And I'll tell you a good story about that later. But now with Casper Focus for the iPad, they have placed great technologies in the hands of the teachers who are managing their classroom deployments. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select the specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn more about Casper Focus, the Casper Suite, and Jamp Software at jampsoftware.com. So, they're like, if you Google or like, go to Amazon and search on like USB-C to USB like standard, or USB-A, I guess is the term. I'm going to make a note here just so I can put that link in there. There is like a ton of cables, like USB-C cables, but like everything with all that, like not all cables are the same. So a Google engineer who works on the Pixel team bought them all and reviewed them, like in detailed reviews of like how it pulls power and things like that, because obviously, you know, that matters for like the MacBook Air and the Chromebook Pixel.
Yeah, these more sophisticated devices they're really starting to kind of push to the outer limits of some of the USB specs, and many cables aren't capable of doing what these devices need them to do.
Right, and so like there was one cable that he said was a great cable. It's a 3-foot, it's an Anker USB-C to USB-A. And so I picked that up for $10. That's one of those, like, I like to have at least one of those cables in my office somewhere, because you never know when you're going to need it. And so we'll link to that in the show notes. But that'd be a great cable if you need to enroll the new Apple TV into your Casper Suite, because you have to load a configuration profile onto it. So moving on, the next thing is the one-to-one deployment planning guide. And this is a terrible guide, and you should just listen to our show instead. Kidding.
Yeah. No, the one-to-one deployment planning guide is pretty good. And the thing I really like about it is that it sort of talks you through like what you would physically do, you know. So it says things like, at this point, plug in an iPad into Apple Configurator, you know, and then it talks about things like preparing for distribution, and it talks about how to run your distribution event and things like that. So it's a really useful document, because I know when I did my, well, not my first distribution, but my second one, I sort of hadn't really considered all the packaging that was coming along now. So, well, actually, I suppose the first one was pretty bad as well, actually, but the second one was rough too. In terms of, like, where am I putting all this shrink wrap stuff? You know, where am I putting the boxes? If you're doing a lease situation like we are, where am I storing all these boxes for 3 years until I have to send them all back in the box again? You know, questions like that. Just thinking about some of that stuff is very useful.
Yeah, it's, again, there's a lot of little things to think about. And so this is a good guide. Again, this is a PDF, so throw this one into PDF Expert. Next thing is the VPP Volume Purchase Program Guide. This is, again, another PDF. And while the Volume Purchase Program works for one school, it actually scales up quite nicely for multiple schools.
Yeah, there's structure in there for having, you know, deputizing the ability to pay for things as well, which is really good.
And one of the things I'd recommend too is if you're doing a lease, you can go ahead and like add in VPP gift cards into your lease. It's just an easy way to kind of get your bank full for your app deployment. But you know, you have your program manager and program facilitator, so it's set up well for one school. If you've got an entire district, and then different, you know, different people at different schools can have different roles. So again, something good to look over and think through how you want your school to be structured, particularly if you have more than one school.
Yeah, the VPP program guide is kind of like a features and benefits document. So it's really good for those high level conversations where you're like, should we get enrolled in VPP or not? And you can use that document to explain to people, look, here are the 10 reasons why we should get VPP, and here are the things we can do if we're in VPP, and so on and so on. And there's a similar document for the Device Enrollment Program Guide as well, which is just, both of them just sort of say, well, if you use them together, you can use them to make a pretty compelling case for doing an institutional deployment where apps are properly managed through VPP and devices are ordered through Apple and enrolled in DEP, and then you can sort of list from there the benefits you get from doing that kind of deployment.
Next thing is the DEP Device Enrollment Program Guide. Again, another PDF. Basically the same as the VPP, but just for DEP.
Yep. And then the next thing you've got, Bradley, is you've got the Apple Deployment Programs Help, which is kind of more technical help with DEP and VPP. So it's things like it tells you which Apple IDs you need to have, or how to make more Apple IDs for these programs and things like that. Because it feels like you're never done making Apple IDs as you're starting up an Apple deployment. And that is true. You're making a lot of them, even just for things like Program Manager and Program Facilitator and VPP. So I think I probably have about 15 or 20 different Apple IDs at the moment for various parts like that. But yeah, the deployment program itself is kind of where you go if you get a bit stuck with something in VPP or DEP.
And then finally is the iOS security white paper. Again, another PDF. And so if you've got someone that's very concerned about the security, if it's a parent or the business person in your school, this is the PDF you want them to send. It's very, very, very deep and very technical. So it's not a high level overview. It is a nitty gritty.
Yeah, you're going to want to have some experience with encryption in order to understand some of the stuff that's done in here. So, I mean, this goes right down to the very deep levels. This is actually not an education document. This is a business document. So this comes from when I mentioned earlier, there's the iOS for IT and education, the iOS for IT and business. And this really comes from the business side of the house. But I think these topics are important for education as well. So it looks at things like how does a trusted boot chain work in iOS? How does a device verify that it has a non-corrupted, non-compromised version of iOS running on it every time it boots? Software verification, You know, checking out that apps are legit and are not hacked or pirated. Data encryption on the device. So how is data encrypted at rest on the device's storage? How is it stored in memory? Code signing for apps. Things like USB trust and device pairing as well. So when you plug an iOS device into a Mac or any USB host, what is the security process by which both sides have to go through in order to get to transfer data over that USB connection, which is very important if you are likely to be randomly charging your iPad off of stuff in various places. And I had one experience where this actually was very interestingly useful, Bradley, was I was on a plane. I can't remember where I was going. I think I was going to the States, and the seatback had a USB-A socket in the seatback. I thought, well, that's great. I'll plug in and I'll just keep my iPhone charged as we fly. And I did. And I plugged in my iPhone, and then it came up on the screen and said, do you want to trust this computer? I was like, wait a minute, how is there a data connection here? I thought this was just for charging. It turned out you could actually, I think you could like download your photographs onto the in-flight entertainment system for some reason. I'm not sure why that was. But I certainly said, don't trust. And then at that point, the experience was just, you know, there was no data flowing from my device because the device didn't trust it. It was all just to do with power. So things like that. Also things like how does Apple Pay work? How does Touch ID work? You know, if you have parents who are concerned about the privacy implications of fingerprint storage on the device, this is where you can send them to, you know, hopefully allay their fears, as long as their fears are reasonably well-founded in reality. And then the last thing, and I think this is critical when you're trying to put a sysadmin hat on, is how to deal with things like device loss, device damage, remote wipe, and other procedures for decommissioning the device at the end of its life. And I think all of those are very important things to think about in terms of the long-term life cycle of deployments in schools as well.
Yeah, this is one to download and read on a long car ride and highlight.
Yeah, and there's some bits you might want to just skip over a little bit because I'll be quite honest with you, there's some bits I don't understand the technical aspects of as well, and I'm not saying that because I'm the most intelligent person in the world or anything that far from it, but I do have a lot of experience and a lot of education in computer science, and there's some bits of that are even beyond my experience and understanding at the moment. So if you're one of the reasons I think this is a useful document for everybody to know about, though, is that quite often, one of the ways in which iOS deployments are blocked in schools is by some security theatre from technical people who don't want to do it. And they'll throw up all kinds of things at you, like, what about data encryption at rest? You know, Mr. Teacher, what's your answer to our concerns about data encryption? And the poor teacher's left going, well, I don't know what happens with data encryption, or how do you trust that the operating system is fully verified? And teachers are just like, I don't know, I just want to have an iPad in my classroom to you know, do Book Creator with, and you're asking me about encryption. And this is, you know, if you are in that situation, what I would suggest is just send these people a link to this document and ask them to point out where there's a technical problem. And if they can't do that, then I think you maybe have carte blanche just to go ahead. So, yeah, that's why this document is really important, I think. It's not just because it gives you confidence, but it's also something you can use to fight back in this security theater war that goes on between IT people and educators, because so many times I've seen this happen that people, you know, I've heard people say that it is illegal under UK law to use an iPad in a classroom. Right, from data protection, though, they've actually tried to argue that, and it's utterly ridiculous. But the problem is that when somebody with a technical hat on comes in and says something that sounds like you might go to jail if you do this, then everybody backs off, right? And then they say, well, you know, we'll just do our Microsoft thing and we'll handle all that for, and Microsoft and us will handle that. But if you do iOS, you're the guy who's going to jail for that. So this is where you can start to, these are some of the documents that you can start to use to fight back on stuff like that. And I think they're very useful in that respect too.
So I think that's it.
I mentioned one other thing, Bradley, just that comes to mind. I don't have links for this just yet, but if you are in the UK and people are hitting you with the Data Protection Act as a reason not to do it, the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK has some excellent guidance on things like bring your own device, mobile computing, cloud computing, cloud storage, and they're very readable and they're very understandable. And what's more importantly, and this is very unusual for government documents, they are very pro-innovation. You know, so if you look at the ICO guidance in cloud computing, they basically say, right, there's risks, but there were risks before, and there's also a risk involved in not doing this. And they make they have a very intelligent way of doing this, and I think it's some of the best technical writing I've seen come out of government in the UK in terms of just, okay, here's the way the world's going. We're going to do it, and we are going to provide you with ways to understand it and deal with it and make sure that you're not violating your obligations under the Data Protection Act and so on. So I think that's another place to go if you are in the UK and you are struggling with that argument in your school or your organisation, is that the Information Commissioner's Office actually kind of has your back on that one as well. So that's good to know too.
Yeah, somebody was asking me earlier about, you know, what are the main differences technology-wise with the US and the EU? And I would say it's that stuff. Like it's yeah. I mean, that is the big thing.
Yeah. And, you know, there was one of the arguments that was sometimes made is that Amazon and Microsoft have got mechanisms by which they can guarantee that your data will reside in a data center within the European Union. And that's one of the principles of data protection in the EU, is that you're not allowed to transfer data outside the European Economic Area is without having adequate privacy protections in the other country. So, for example, Canadian privacy law is considered to be equivalent to EU privacy law, but US privacy law is not. And this becomes a problem because all the good technology comes from America and everything that comes from Europe is pretty crap by comparison. So what Microsoft and Amazon have done is they've put data centers in Ireland, and this is actually a pretty good business for Ireland, is because they host a lot of the data centers that these companies put in the EU. And I know Apple's talking about doing one, but it's not there yet. And Google I believe there are ways in which you can guarantee that with Google as well. But Apple have historically not done that yet. But that's going to be a thing everybody's going to eventually do, because there's increasingly this sort of fallout between Europe and the US. And over technology in particular. And I think one of the ways that US tech companies are going to try and appease the European Union is to put data centers in the EU. And as the law currently stands, that's one of the things, one of the ways in which they can make that easy for companies or organizations like us in the UK who want to use American technology, but maybe don't want to transfer data outside the EU. There's also this thing called the Safe Harbor provisions, which is basically an agreement between the EU and the US that American companies will abide by EU data protection rules. And that was recently ruled to be illegal in Europe, so that's going to have to be renegotiated in some way, I think. But it was quite interesting because quite quickly after that came out, the UK Information Commissioner Office came out and said, look, okay, this has been struck down by some European court at the moment, but don't rush to do something about it just yet because there's renegotiation on the horizon. So even though, you know, there had been a legal ruling about this, that you shouldn't be doing it, the ICO came out very quickly afterwards and said, yes, this has happened. Don't freak out. Don't restructure everything. Just, you know, sit tight for a while and, you know, see what happens, and there'll be some negotiated agreement with it at some later date. So, you know, even just being as proactive as that, I was super impressed with the ICO as well. So it's, and just to finish off, Bradley, sorry to go on about this, but they also have a newsletter, which, honest to goodness, is the most terrifying thing that will ever land in your inbox, because I'm reading it through parted fingers going, I can't believe what has happened here. And they tell you all these tales about somebody was taking home confidential social work reports in a plastic bag and they left it on the train, you know, and you're like, you know, that's the world that we're dealing with. And you're telling me that cloud computing is not secure enough, you know, and you've literally, and this is one of the things I think in the long run, this is really important, because If you secure your systems to such an extent that people are taking plastic bags of paper home on the train just to get their job done, then you have fundamentally failed in your approach to security. Because I know, you know, from our point of view, we never print that stuff out and take it around the place, you know, because we have access to cloud-based access to cloud-based documents that people can access from any device, anywhere, that's secured with two-factor authentication and all this kind of stuff. And we don't print stuff out in a plastic bag and take it on the train with us home. We take it digitally encrypted, secure, accessible, but we can still get our work done as well. And you see the difference there between those two approaches? Super important.
I mean, there's a pendulum between security and usability. And if you go too far either way, then you got problems, but you got to ride that fine line. And there, there's no 100% security, but you can't make it so hard that people, people are basically printing stuff out and taking it home.
Because you can't demand that people do their jobs and then not give them any tools with which to do their job. And because then you're just asking for them to work around your system. Because if they've got more work than they can do in the office and you're demanding that they do work at home as well, but then you don't give them any tools, what are they going to do?
Well, I saw a meme one time that said $100,000 intrusion prevention system. Employee puts customer data on Dropbox.
Yeah, exactly. Or they print it out. And the printer is probably actually most organizations' number one data breach area. Certainly in schools, you see this all the time in the ICO documents. Two people's reports were printed out, and one sheet went with another report, and it got sent to the wrong person, and so on and so on. And it's just that, you could never sleep again if you read some of these stories. It's terrifying.
You would burn it all down and go live in the woods.
At least switch off your printer.
Well, for the next 2 weeks, you can do that, because we won't have a new show. So, we'll be back, like I said, in January, and we'll kick off our deployment series. And me and my family, we hope everyone has a very Merry Christmas and a very happy New Year as well.
Absolutely. Thanks to everybody for being part of Out of School again for another year. We've really enjoyed what's happened this year. I think there's been some really great stuff has happened. iOS 9 has been amazing. iPad Pro has been great. I think it's been a good year for Apple admins overall.
Absolutely. In the meantime, you can listen to some other shows. The Serial is back, and I'd also recommend Exponent if you haven't listened to that. And then, of course, if you're needing something fun and a bit scary, Lore for my friend Aaron Mahanke is a great show to catch up on and binge if you haven't. And I am thankful to say that I knew him before Lore was popular. And now he's like a megastar, and I've got a cell phone number.
He's on the top new podcast on iTunes?
Oh, yeah. It's huge. It's booked out. Sponsorships are booked out for a year. And Aaron's just like a super fun guy. We get together about once a year and have dinner. And it's like one of those people that it couldn't happen to a nicer guy, like all his success. Mm-hmm. But it's also fun. A lot of people will talk about overnight success. And he's been writing supernatural books for a couple years now. And they did fine. But it wasn't like they took off. And I just kept telling him, hey, man, keep pulling at the strings. Just keep doing it. And then, and that's the thing. It took years to get to, okay, now he has this, amazing project. Most people are he just started a podcast and he got lucky. Well, no, but he's been, grinding it for years and, couldn't have a nicer guy. So, lorepodcast.com. I would highly recommend you check out that over Christmas break.
Don't listen alone.
Yes, do not. It's good, very good show. He does a real nice job. And again, I love it when people that I feel like deserve success and have worked their tails off reach massive success. Couldn't be happier for him.
That's great.
I am on the web at chambersdaily.com, on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
Mm-hmm. And I'm spears.org on the web and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
We'll see you in January.
Take me out to the ball game.